Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me here, for having this invitation and sharing with you now, right before lunchtime, which is, of course, a challenge. A very different storyline I'd like to talk to you about today. Well, challenges in the real world, the culture of eating. Now, what am I going to try to talk to you today? First, we are in the real world, in the everyday life situation of the people. And then I'd like to talk a little bit, what do I understand about what is culture of eating? And then I would like to address this question and focus on a single case of a family, which I would like to introduce to you, and give you some very first insights of the study I did to try to understand what is out there in the real world and how does that bind together into culture of eating and challenges that we are facing today. So, as you all know, we have many challenges today. We all have to face with every day. Just to give you a small overview, which is of course selective, the huge information that we have to deal with, what is the right decision, and how about different food choices, and how about changes that we had when we look back into our history. We had being served at the point of sale, and nowadays we have to make selections in large food stores. We have a challenge of the growing population. We have challenges that people are getting older. We have challenges in the way of how we move and how we have mobilization. We have the urbanization on the world scale. And of course, we have different prices. We have peak oil. And there are consequences of those challenges in our culture, on the life, in the way that we have the problem of obesity. On the other side, we have hunger, starvation. We have a sedentary lifestyle, we have poverty, we have aspects of sustainability, and we have climate change, we have food waste, and how do we handle that? How do we handle challenges? It is like trying to eat an elephant with a spoon. How do you do that? Well, of course, we cannot tackle all the challenges at one time. We have to select one by one. So I decided I'd like to look at one of these challenges that we have today in our society, which is the demographic change that we face, and that we face with many, many consequences. Well, a demographic change, just to give you a small insight, is that we have a change in the ratio of children to older citizens. And that we have, due to our demographic change, a change in the nature of illnesses that occur. And we also face, in different cultures, a different speed of aging. And this is even so in our highly developed countries, where we are having now at the moment almost a fifth of our population being over 65. And in a couple of years, this will be a third. And we have to face a situation that within the next years, half of the population in Germany will be over 50 years. So what you see here is a pyramid, inverted comma, of Germany and a major transition that we face between 2016 now or 17 and in a couple of years, that we will have a demographic change, meaning that a third of the population is over 65 years. And this is new in history of mankind, that we are having such a large proportion of people reaching that age. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful that we are getting older, yet if we are getting older, we want to maintain our quality of life while we are getting older. And that means it's not our question how to extend longevity, but rather how to optimize the years to lie ahead of us, how we are getting a quality of life while we are getting older. And you all know there are many recommendations. I'm just quickly running through them. And now I'm coming back, or this quickly running through, is that it's a rather easy, inverted comma, easy way of how to enhance health. And I'm just coping on quoting WHO that says, well, increase the amount of plant-based food, eat less sugar and red meat, if alcohol in moderation, and then, of course, increase your physical activity level, have more social contacts. And we've heard a lot about that. And have a meaningful life. Meaningful means that I know why I'm getting up every morning. So these are some of the major influences, and this is also connected to our eating behavior. And we've heard a lot about eating behavior, why it's so difficult to change behavior, and how we can enhance habits and habit formation. So what is the culture of eating? And now I apologize, I brought a rather long definition which has been established here at Max Hubner Institute that quotes what is eating behavior, what belongs to eating behavior. And I'm just quoting that to just broaden the picture to the culture of eating, because it's such a complex issue, this culture of eating and the eating behavior, so that it is not all that easy. What are we looking at if we are talking about the culture of eating? So I'm trying now to lead you through this very complex definition, trying to boil it down to some aspects that we can look at to understand the complexity of the culture of eating. And why is it that we eat? Well, most people, of course, eat to live. But as we all know, we also can have a statement, I live to eat. So now coming back to a case study, to families or to individuals, I wondered what happens when we're getting older. Where do people come from and what formed their eating behavior? And if there is maybe a situation where we can look at families and the development of their eating cultures. Now, we all know that eating behavior is learned predominantly in a family situation. And that it's not just the parents that are important during infancy, but it's also maybe the grandparents that might play a role in that. So it could be a new area to look what happened in the trajectory if we broaden up such questions to a more longer period where people came from to form cultures of eating behavior. And I'm trying now also to boil that down to introduce to you a sort of a small, very, very basic eating model, trying to look at what forms and shapes our eating behavior. Of course, it's the person's context. So in every eating culture, it's persons that we have to look at. But we also have to look at an aerial context, because we always eat connected to a certain place, be it at a table, be it in a room, be it in a region. So it's also a matter of time. We've heard about time issues, but food itself has a lot of triggers of time in itself. Just eating a food is a placeholder for a certain time of the day, because we are usually not eating certain foods at certain times, such as in our culture of eating in Germany, it's not common that you might eat a cooked lunch at breakfast time on a population level. So time, season, but also the history. And of course we eat because we have certain ideals, aims, and We also eat because we eat food. What we decide as a culture is food. It's not the same in the other cultures. So we have to look at that issue as well. And of course, the values, the religions, the beliefs people have. And that binds together into that kind of easy model or simple model, like a jigsaw, these aspects of eating. And then if we look at the nutrition behavior, we know that people eat accordingly to those various aspects. And we eat usually meals. We eat not just a food, but a meal is always in a certain given situation. Now, if we are looking now at eating behavior, what we eat has always a history. It has a history that the way how we handle food, what we like and prefer, what kind of expectations we have, the manners and the regulation at the family level on the table, this has a history. And it is constituted in each person, in each one of you, the way how you eat, the way how you look at food, the way how you handle food. This is not just there, it has a history. And this history is something that has got to do with the culture, with the social situation where you grew up. So, in a way, this comes from also the cultural aspects where you grew up, meaning that you, all of you, grow up in a certain time with a certain technical development stage in each country, in each place where you live. You also live in a context where you have a certain political development and history with regulations and rules. And you also live in a situation where you have certain economic developments and challenges. And also, we've heard about such technological developments, the iPhone 2007. So there is obviously an interaction with the food, with the way how we deal with food, that's not independent from all those outer aspects such as food technology or changes of morals and values in a given situation. We are all born into a certain situation where these aspects already exist and develop. Now, trying now to extend my questions to what is it that really shaped and formed the way how we eat today. And I'd like to focus to you now, if we have a woman, say she was born 1926, and I'll give you a real example of the family. She was born 1926. That means these aspects of social, cultural, influencing factors have been formed while she was young, almost 90 years ago. But she has been raised by parents that have been living at least 25 years before. And this is trying to look at a generational approach. So if we look at the ideal typical period of a generation, it implies 25 years. 25 years, demographers calculate there is one generation. In reality, a generation can expand to much more than 25 years because not all of your parents were 25 when they had you as a child. So, but nevertheless, looking at that, these 1926 born women, 90 years old, ideally, she had her children between 1951 and 1942, and then you see their children are already born and great-grandchildren. Going back now to such a way of how to look into biographical generational aspects, I brought you a slide which looks complicated but is still very, very superficial and simple. On the top, you see political events. Here, you
you see the numbers 1900 until present. You have in Germany, this is Germany, certain political great events that happened. You have the monarchy, World War I, World War II, the Cold War, then the construction of Berlin Wall, then the fall of the Berlin Wall, the reunification. Just political events that none of us really could influence, but they were given. And the same with economic events, the food prices being down, the Golden 20s, and then introduction of Europe. Just some aspects. The technological aspects. You had the running water in urban private homes, you had the first building kitchen in the 20s. Then you had, since the 50s, the general electrification in Germany. You have building kitchens, you have the revival of Eden kitchen as a showroom. Now what you can do, just by looking at that, just imagine where is your birth date and what age where were your parents born. And then you just go down and look what was there when they were children. What was there as an environmental cue to form and shape their eating behavior. Let me move on. What is normal for you? Our kids, it's normal for them to have an iPhone or a smartphone. And it's normal for them that the way how they interact, that you interact by smartphone. For those that were born before, it's not, it's new. So, but also on the food science level, we have various changes. And we have changes also in the norms and values. So this goes back to this jigsaw puzzle of the eating behavior model that I used. Now, looking from there on, I tried to give you some impressions what these women born in 26 experienced. The wood stuff, nowadays, this kind of stuff. She was used to go to the shop to be served. Now this is that, what we have today. She was, you know, used to have the real animal which she knew would be slaughtered. This is what we face today. She had new real food. Now we have the 3D printer. She was used that there were times when food was scarce and they had to line up for food. Now we have food waste. And now maybe she has a personalized package that someone ordered for her to have confectioned food packages to cook her lunch. Now, how would that bind in a case study? Is it possible to go into a family situation and try to look at eating patterns, meal patterns, from the childhood until today? So I used a qualitative approach. A qualitative approach trying to go into one single case to understand what is happening there. Because I didn't know. I had to talk to people. I had to try to see what happened in their life. And if this is a feasible method, can it tell us something? Can it tell us about the challenges and how to go about it? So it was not the aim that I used that I had to produce representative results. I wanted to understand. So I was very lucky to get an inside person, to get to know an intermediary that introduced me to a very special family I'd like to introduce. This family is living in Southwest Germany. The parents were born between 1877, this was Michael, and his wife, Martha. She was born in 1885 and died in 1957. They had 15 children. They married in 1905. The first child was born 1907, which refers to F2 generation. The last child was born in 1929. The first grandchild was born just 3 years after the youngest child. And the last grandchild was born in 1968. So they were already in the third generation.
32 persons.
In the fourth generation, the first great-grandchild was born in 1962, and the last great-grandchild was born in 2008. And it was difficult. I tried to find out, and it took me a long time to even figure out all the persons in the third generation, and there are already two of them are dead, and not all of them yet I have had the chance to reach. And the fifth generation, there are assumptions that it's 17 right now. But what you also see is the difference in one generation. I said a demographer says it's 25 years, but in this family already it's one generation more or less, with 15 children, 22 years. In the grandchild generation, it's already 36 years. And even more so in the four great-grandchildren, it's 46 years, so it's almost two generations. And you see an overlap of the generations, of course, because here you have the last grandchild and the first great-grandchild has overrun each other. Now, what happened in that family and what can I tell you about it? I conducted five qualitative interviews. Two of the daughters are still alive, the 14th and the 15th child. And the 14th child is the lady that was born in 1926. Her sister was born in 1929. Most of these family members presently live in Southwest Germany, and all grandchildren even grew up in Germany. Two of them migrated to Canada in adulthood, but their childhood, this time where we say that formation of food habits is most prominent, was in Southwest Germany. I conducted interviews so far with the females, with these two ladies and some of their daughters, and the oldest living grandson. He was born in 1937. As I said, Laura was alive and Reinhild born in 1929. Laura has five children, 14 grandchildren and one great-grandchild. I did multiple interviews with Laura and one of her daughter and one granddaughter. Reinhild, she was born in 1929. She has three children, four grandchildren, one great-grandchild. I did an interview with the daughter born in 1954. And the fourth child of Martha, she was born in 1910, died in 1971, had two children. Gerhard, he was born in 1937. I did interview with him. Daughter Mira, she died in 2011. Elisabeth has five grandchildren and five great-great-grandchildren. Now, this is Martha and Michael at their marriage. Martha was 19, Michael 27. This is them. As the tradition there, the bride was in black. This is the family at about 1932. Now you see these two. This is Michael, Martha. This is Reinhild, the youngest, Laura. And this is Elisabeth, the mother of Gerhard. And here you see the picture in 1947. One son died during World War II. This is Martha. This is Michael. That's Laura. That's Reinhild. This is Elisabeth. Now, let's look about aspects of the eating behavior. Start with cooking. Martha had learned cooking from her mother. Martha served as a young girl, as a housemaid in a bourgeois household before she got married. And in 1932, a Swabian cookbook
was published. The topics were basic recipes, instruction how to cook housewifely and resourceful. And Martha was a passionate cook. She always wanted to learn something new because she had a large family, so she had to do it in a housewifely, economical way. She trained her daughters, all of her daughters, but not their sons. And what is most important,
now I want to go to the back. Would you please help me get
up? Yes. Oh,
because there's something in there. Because I begged Laura to provide me a copy of her cookbook. Because Martha passed this cookbook as a hard copy to her daughters upon marriage. One daughter's not in marriage. And she had also trained cooking as a shore of the females. This cookbook still exists today. It's still there in the 56th edition. And it's passed down to the family. And I smell, because you even smell.
This is the cookbook. It's Luise Haare, Kochen und Backen nach Grundrezepten. This is what it looks today. It's still used as a school book, as a school cookbook. This is an edition I checked from 1974. But still it's in use today, even to the great-granddaughters. Martha was pragmatic and practical, and you have to imagine, all work was manual. She had no electricity in her childhood. The electrical stuff came in the mid-50s. Before that, it was wood and gas. The food she used for her family to feed was produced in the garden. It was conserved at home, salted, fermented, pasteurized, dried, stored in the cellar, as all of the people did in that time. And of course, there was no convenience. Fruits and apples were used to make juice. And these training were passed to the daughters in a matrilineal way, even up to the grandchildren today. So Laura's daughters and granddaughters, they use, of course, social media and internet to get ideas how to cook and use recipes. But as these interviews revealed, they still look up basic recipes in this cookbook. Special cooking and recipes are still performed up to date. And when I talk to Laura's daughter, Laura as the 14th child, Laura's daughter, who was born in 1960, she told me that for Christmas Eve, she had soup with dumplings, potato salad, and sausage on Christmas Eve, just as her mother, Laura, and her grandmother, Martha, had. The same with Christmas Day. She had the same recipe even as her mother, Laura, who had retrieved this recipe from her mother, Martha. So you kind of see a genealogy, a trajectory of recipes being used up to the present. Now let's look at the time. The time frame in this generational approach. Martha's cooking was taking all morning. Meals were really distinct. Breakfast around 7, second breakfast at around 10 a.m., bread and cold cuts, cooked lunch around noon. In the afternoon, they had coffee around 3, no coffee, of course, substitutes, and you had a bread-based dinner around 6. Now, how did that change in the next generation? Cooking is, of course, then by then, and these are the external technology developments I try to refer to. Cooking is far less time consuming, so it takes approximately 1 hour You have more flexibility. They are not as distinct, but still you have these peaks, as we've seen in the French culture. You can kind of see it also here. And some data from the National Nutrition Survey too still indicates those peaks. Breakfast was around 7 to 8, usually no second breakfast. Cooked lunch at around 12 or 1, but always cooked, no cold cuts. Usually no afternoon snack, but still a bread-based dinner at around 6. Some convenience, but still no use of microwave or steamer. Still the cooked lunch from scratches, most of it. Now, the third generation, of course, has even more so a change. The time decreases. Takes about 30 minutes. Still about 7 to 8, the breakfast, usually no second breakfast. Lunch at around 12, 1, sometimes a little bit later, but not necessarily cooked. Often out of home. Usually no afternoon snack, as their parents or grandparents did. And dinner is often cooked instead. If you did not have a lunch cooked, you have a cooked dinner. And of course you use convenience products. Because you also have the technologically in your private home. You have a microwave, you have a deep freezer, you have a steamer. So you can use convenience food. It's like a key and a hole. Because without the technology in the private home, you cannot use these products that are on the market. Or otherwise, if you put them on the market, you need a certain technology in your private home. Preferences of males. Well, Martha cooked what her husband liked, of course, always, ever. And what was available during season. And Laura's daughter, she reported a story from the late 70s. Laura tried to bring in new dishes. And the 70s, beginning of 80s, was the rise of the whole food. Before that was. And of course the family liked it, but the husband didn't. So of course it was not continued. But Laura's daughter, of course, she cooks according to her children's preferences and her own preference. Because the absence of the husband does make it necessary that she, of course, adapts to the children. Well, back in Martha's time and in Laura and in Reinhild's days, it was necessary to be housewifely, to be economically. But today, we are not talking about housewifely, but we talk about sustainability and to be sustainable in what we do. As the interviews revealed, food played a very important issue in this family. It was considered sinful to waste food. But food, of course, was a gendered issue. The production of it, the storing, the shopping, the clearance afterwards. And then we also have to go back to what happened when Reinhild and Laura grew up. They reported to have been very hungry when they were children after World War II. And food was never self-evident. It was not just available 24 hours, 7 days a week. Food, therefore, was a gift, and you are grateful if you get a gift. Yet, it seems that this kind of gratefulness today is still present, but it is filled with other values. It's filled with the value of sustainable, of an ethical approach to food. So, what are common values in this family? The value that food is central. It's not a luxurious aspect of food. It's meaning a good quality. And that you have food as a gift. And that you say grace or thank you for such a gift. I try to condensate these findings in this slide. Now, what you see here are the meals, the time, and the values. You see here the generation of Martha and Michael, as far as I could retrieve it through the interviews. I have to be very clear where I got this information. The meals were regular, only with the family. Soup always
every day. Only seasonal and regional food. Never, never any food waste. Special dish on Sunday. In this family, I was told two different kinds of types of meat. And, of course, father before stir. Really good. It's almost like a stir. Father being served first. And then, of course, according to age and gender, yours last. The time, as I said, regular. The values cling solely to the chores of females. Eating table manners important. Children have to be quiet. Preferences of meals and food is gift. In the next generation, the children also regularly sell out home, sometimes in restaurants, mainly traditional food, rarely food waste, some convenience food, but always cook lunch around noon. And of course, still here, mostly it's the female part. And eating and table manners are important, and of course, so the husband has his preferences. But also, it seems that healthy eating is important. Yeah. In the third generation, it's most of the time, according to other family situations, out of home quite often, and in international cooking as well, convenience food, of course, there's some food waste. And it's mostly a cooked lunch, but very often it's in the evening. And it's sometimes also that the males take over accordingly to what happens. Yes, food is not self-evident. And in the fourth generation, the meals depend. Sometimes with friends, sometimes out of the house. Eating is value-driven, and of course you use the extension of international recipes, and you have more food waste, yet again, there is still this kind of aspect of sustainability, we shouldn't waste. But not because it's economically important, but because it's something that you shouldn't do. Time depends, the males cook as well, yet females are still more the ones that are doing the chores. And food is lifestyle. Well, what do we learn from this very small case study? And I'm just trying to picture some of the social challenges in the context of culture of eating. And I was trying to look at one single case to try to understand what other challenges are there that we have to look at to understand how this might interact.
We know that nutrition behavior is part of human behavior. And it's shaped during life course in a certain given context that we are born into. And we learn nutrition behavior from our parents. But our parents are brought up by their parents, so it might help to understand what shaped the nutrition behavior of our parents or even great-grandparents. So it kind of extends. And we have to understand that the rucksack of our behavior is packed at a very early stage of our life. When we are 7 years old and we get into school, most of our routines and habits that we have been talking about has been learned. We know how to use the cutlery. We know what kind of food we eat during each time of the day, that there are special foods, that there are rewards about food. This is something that we already learned and we have been trained by our parents. Such as structures and meanings of food, skills and values, and some of them seem to have a certain trajectory during the generations. And I think it might help to understand these trajectories in a given context of the real world, in order to maybe enhance our understanding to the evolution of nutrition behavior in people today. So, even today, of course, we can see that it's still the females that have the role of cooking on a daily basis, even today, and such large national surveys still show it, that it's still the main chore of the women, and that the cooking skills are, if A family has sons and daughters, usually transformed more onto the patrilinear level. And there are certain studies that show that there is a transmission of cooking and eating style from the mothers to the daughters. Yes, this matrilinear pattern seems to diminish. Why so? Because the transmission of cooking skills means that there is someone that is engaged in the cooking and be there when the children are there to kind of transmit this pattern. And due to the changes on the political level that more women are in workforce, more children are now tending to be out of the home during schooling time, this interaction time decreases. So it's also seeming that the cooking theme was kind of filled with prejudices.
Back in the 70s, 60s, 80s, because it meant that it's something that's against women's liberation. So you wouldn't talk about cooking skills. And you try not to kind of be in that trajectory of acquiring knowledge on cooking and household keeping. But nowadays, it seems that this topic is not as morally uploading any longer, and males can bridge in and take that and go back to cooking. So cooking today seems to be a lifestyle issue instead of a gendered moral issue in the respect of women's liberation. So there is a moral or a value change in our society. So this is why it seems that males are getting more engaged in
cooking and food preparation. But I don't know, because it's always important to look at the family situation, what happens in the formation of a family situation if this is still then the male to do the daily day chore of cooking. I don't know. We'll see. Now, to finalize and conclude, I try to give you a picture, a very rough overview of the many challenges that we face today due to demographic changes. And I try to go into one family as a case study to understand what happens in the trajectory, in the way of how certain behavior are transmitted from one generation to the next, in order to better understand how nutrition behavior is transformed, and maybe this can help us and open the view for further research topics. And now I'm hoping for some question discussion. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very, very much for your presentation, which really is an eye-opener in special respects, and I really remember things from my parents and from my grandmother. It's really, as if you
Any questions?
So, really, thank you. I think that's really impressive, and I love to look at these kind of pictures because it really shows big changes. Actually, I have two questions. So, you were kind of saying that the time changes. So, I have the impression that we eat less often. So, that doesn't also mean that we eat actually less. Because we don't have this almost kind of the small breakfast at 10, and then we have coffee and then cake in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
This is kind of unhealthy stuff.
Well, again, this is a family situation. And what I didn't tell you, I tried to reach all the family members via a questionnaire that I had developed. But I have not finished. It's still ongoing because it's so difficult to get all the addresses, and I have to kind of dig through the family where I try to get a more quantitative picture of what actually did you eat and how much. I cannot tell you about that now. So all I know is that the meals in itself changed. I could not yet really go into this deep aspect of what kind of substitute meals do you have instead and the snacking in between. This I didn't.
But it's very interesting to see the timing.
Yes, yes.
Thank you for that interesting presentation. It's really exciting. I was wondering whether females could to please their husbands or their according to their preferences. Did you also ask them about whether they get assistance, for example, from their mother-in-law? Because I guess.
Yes. 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 Yes, this I did. And it is interesting. There are some, I'd say, more special occasions where these recipes from the mother-in-law came in. Yet on a daily basis, at least for Martha and Laura, they made the decision. And they kind of course, try to please their husband, but just do not forget that the eating culture is always regional. And the mates of these, from Laura and from Reinhild, came rather close by. So there is a common tradition of a kitchen that has been there. Of course, you have individual spicing what you do, or maybe you have a different kind of way of how you prepare your soup, but still it is a soup. So the structure was similar, and special recipes were coming in from, yes, the mother-in-laws, but the predominant way, because the parent or the males, at least until the oldest grandson generation, Gerhard, they were kind of pleased with what their wife has cooked, and they decided it was the female part. So, of course, it had to feed their taste, and they would rebel if it was not what they expected, but still it was their chore. They wouldn't intervene.
Yeah, thank you so much for an inspiring talk. I would have at least a half a dozen questions and another half a dozen comments to you, but only one question now. We'll talk about the others later in the breaks.
Yes.
Talk about reciprocal learning between generations from the children when they become young adults to the parents, because in my generation, this is what I see happening all the time. Like my friends and other people that I know are changing their long-time habits and behaviors because their children became teenagers and young adults, and they have very different values that they are creating, and sustainability and all that. And all of a sudden, we are reducing our meat intake, we are changing our old recipes and traditions, even during the Christmas Eve, which is our main kind of thing for the whole year. We don't have the big ham anymore, which we had for generations, because the young people say that we want to have some vegan thing. And so this is a really big change.
Thank you very much for that, because this is really an issue. I think here we have to look at the different age groups rather than generations, because the generations overlap. In Laura's and Reinhild's generation, I would say there is, yes, some, but not very much interaction. Yet in the next generation, there is already this kind of intense interaction between the generations, not so much if it comes to core meals such as Christmas or whatever. So this is really an area where you don't touch. It's more or less sacrificed area. But there was one incident that Laura told me about her mother, Martha. Laura got to know peppers in the early 50s. Peppers was not a dish that was common in Southwest Germany. And at the beginning, these peppers were often bitter in taste. And Laura invited her mother to such a dish where she had prepared red peppers stuffed with minced meat. And they were bitter. And Martha never, ever tried them again. On the other side, Laura and her family, they had some new recipes, but it was always then the last gatekeeper was the husband to decide if he liked it or not. So it's really depending. But of course, now in the fourth generation, there you have this back and forth. Laura's grandson is now, after his graduation from the university, back to become a cook. So it's in a way more or less the joy of cooking that may have been passed on, and not the gender issue that has been passed on. It would need much more in-depth studies of such kind to see what kind of a pattern there is. The questionnaire that I introduced in this family was used in a small-scale study I used together with two colleagues, and we questioned our students to see if there is a generational pattern or at least a trend trajectory of certain food groups that are more or less consumed during childhood or in adulthood in an intragenerational and extra generational approach. And we could see in that small scale study with about 250 participants, 50 grandparents, 100 parents, and 100 students, that there are some food groups that are maintained from childhood to adulthood, and there are transformations within the generations. So, and these kind of questions, I'm, you know, trying to go back now to Laura and, of course, to Reinhild. I've conducted at least 5 interviews with Laura already and gained a lot of insight in that family, what happened and how, and back, trying also to get contact to the F3 generation, which is rather difficult because they are scattered and sometimes it's just a bit of information and trying to then get hold of them, their addresses. So I'm trying to understand the picture, but I have always to look at what time did they grow up. And this is why I'm trying also to understand the history and the technology that was there when they were growing up, and maybe even going back to Martha's and Michael's childhood.
Christine, thank you for the insight of the historical development. My hypothesis would be, perhaps we have digital revolution at the moment, and we have also an interruption of this chain of nutrition and physical activity habits, because that's one of our hypotheses in our social interaction, for example, in our project, that we say it's not typical anymore that the parents influence only the children, also the other way around, and so we get a new revolution in the chain. Of nutrition habits and physical activity.
Yeah, I mean, there are other such revolutions where, you know, Neil Postman, he wrote about the change of childhood due to modern TV consumption, that kind of erased the difference of being legible from being non-legible. So that changed the childhood, because children understand pictures just as well as adults do, but the interpretation, of course, is different. So I'm very sure that the digital revolution kind of erases maybe such barriers. So there is a transformation of information flow, because of course we are not digital natives, as our children are, and they need to teach us. I mean, it was so nice that you refer to, and I just had to laugh, that we, my generation, myself included, I inherit the old iPhones from my kids, and that my children have to teach me how to, you know, install certain app services or whatever. So this is the way how it works. And just future studies will show us what happens then, where we have all more or less the same level. But as we know, we always have change. It's never static. And we live in a dynamic world. That's the real world. It's nothing that is static. And we have to go and deal about that.